Okay, anything, I guess it's all sort of preliminary here. But maybe before we hit the substantive questions, we should address any sort of procedural housekeeping questions. By the way, if you want to turn your attendance sheets in today, that's fine. If you forgot them, that's fine too. You can, at some point, get them to my secretary. So they go in the file. So again, any sort of test format questions? I forgot to post the shrunken visual outline. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering, but what's the difference between the imputed knowledge test and...
Imputed test knowledge, that's an interesting concept. Let me address that, but I would like to sort of do any sort of format housekeeping questions if there are any. Hearing none, Ms. Peterson. Oh, right, yeah. I will first email you announcing it is finished and I'm done, and then you can either call the registrar and ask them for your grade, or you can, if that doesn't work, email me and I can look it up. Yeah, you'll as soon as they're done, I'll hand it over to Sue, the difference being instead of handing them all out, by the way, I should get those back, the prior tests, I'd like to get them back, but instead of handing them all out to you, you'll have to go track Sue down, and she'll have a file full of them so she can pull it out and give it to you. Yeah. They will be, as a matter of fact, but that depends on the registrar actually getting them done and putting them in. As soon as I turn the grades into the registrar, the list of the grades, I will email everybody and say it's done, but it may take them a while to actually post it. But it's maybe like a day or so that it takes them to post it. Maybe not even that long, but... Other format, housekeeping questions. Okay, then let's talk about substance here. And the first question has to do with... give me the question again.
If you could just go over to this line... How are we supposed to figure it all out?
Okay. Go over design defects again. Again, what I would say is to figure out from the problem, kind of in descending levels of generality, what can I tell my client that will be helpful in evaluating this case? Oftentimes, I put you in the position of representing the plaintiff. If so, be a little bit different if you represent the defendant, but if you represent the plaintiff, here's the kind of way you would think about it. First of all, do I have an injury that resulted from, you know, a product that caused that injury? Did the plaintiff get injured because some product hurt them or failed to function as it was supposed to? If so, then I would certainly consider, evaluate, analyze whether or not I had a product liability claim against that product's manufacturer. Then I would, or as sort of part of that, I would say what kind of a claim, or I guess the next stage would be to say, I would have a claim, the plaintiff would be able to recover damages if the plaintiff can prove a defect. Can the plaintiff prove that the product had a defect that caused the plaintiff's injury. Well, what kind of a defect? If the nature of the defect is a manufacturing defect, there's something wrong with this particular product, then the test that we apply is simple and straightforward. It's the out-of-spec test. That is, does it not match the specifications for that product? On the other hand, if the claim that I would have is that there was something defective about the design or the nature of the warning that accompanied the product, if it's a design defect case, then I have to figure out what kind of test will be used to evaluate whether or not the design of the product is defective. And in essence, I could tell my client it's typically some variation on a negligence theme. One variation is this idea of an imputed knowledge test. That is, we would ask whether or not a reasonable manufacturer, if that manufacturer had the knowledge we now have about the product imputed to that manufacturer, would such a manufacturer then market the product as they did? Or would a reasonable person recognize, gee, the risk of this product outweighs whatever utility there is from this design? It would be better, it would be reasonable to change the design of this product so it was less dangerous. Now again, the difference between that imputed knowledge test and an ordinary negligence test is most significant when there's some discrepancy between what was known at the time and what we know today. If there is no discrepancy, you can pretty much explain this to your client as a straight negligence test. It's true, some jurisdictions employ some variation on a consumer expectations test, and maybe that would make a difference. I don't know. I have to look at the facts. Is it a case where you could say, gee, the risk utility test, evaluating on an engineering basis whether a reasonable person would use this design, a risk utility test goes one way, a consumer expectations test goes another way. That's a very sophisticated comparison. I'm not sure in this scope of a 3-hour exam with lots of other things to cover, I can really do justice to the difference between a consumer expectations test and a risk utility test. If I can, more power to me. But don't just sort of throw that language in there in the hope that, well, gee, I'll impress the professor by showing I know the term consumer expectations and risk utility. The point is, am I helping my client understand this case any better? Am I getting any closer to predicting the name of the game here is, will my client be able to recover damages from this product manufacturer? If I'm not getting any closer by talking about risk utility and consumer expectations, then why bother would be my position. So on the other hand, to the extent that you say, gee, I do feel like I'm making progress, if I knew that this was a consumer expectations test, I would be closer to being able to predict the likelihood that the plaintiff will be able to recover. But most of the heavy lifting here is simply getting to the point where you say, this is a design defect case, or this is a warning case, and this is the kind of issue the jury will have to consider. Whether or not this design, this particular aspect of the design, is one that a reasonably prudent person would use. Whether with today's knowledge on a strict liability basis, or with the knowledge available at the time, a true negligence test, or some variation on that theme.
So the risk utility test is...
A little louder so the folks in the back.
So the risk utility test is strict liability, and the imputed knowledge test is...
Well, see, even that, I mean, I understand the desire to actually get this straight. and sort of have it all in a nice, neat little box, and I salute that. On the other hand, again, one of the things that we have to recognize is it may be straight in my mind, and if I ran the universe, this is how I would do it. Or if DeWolf ran the universe, this is the way it would work. There may be some nice, coherent, clean, consistent package. I'd like to think so. But again, remember the nature of the task that you have on this exam. You have a client who's trying to evaluate whether to go forward with a product liability claim or whether a product liability claim will affect the claim against other defendants in the case. And before we offer some nice, neat, packaged solution to that question, we need to ask ourselves the question, does that really fit the reality? Can I tell my client, because your case fits within this box, that's the way it's going to be resolved? Instead, you may say, look, the issue which I am quite confident is going to be the question before the House, regardless of the jurisdiction, is whether this product is defective. That's going to be the question. How courts answer that question of whether it's defective varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Some employ a test closer to a true negligence test. That seems to be where the restatement wants to take all these jurisdictions, but the restatement third has been less than a box office smash. Some jurisdictions like Washington cling to a test they call strict liability, but they've got a statute which is difficult to decipher. So again, how much progress am I making toward answering the question, will a court ultimately determine that this product is defective? As long as I'm making progress at that point, I should keep on trucking on. But at the point where I begin to, you know, it's two steps forward and three steps back, I should turn my attention to something else where I can make more progress. And as I say, if you wind up in this situation saying, I'm about as smart about this as the Washington legislature or the Washington Supreme Court, ain't a bad place to stop. Okay? So much for Ms. Cleveland.
For product liability, a retail seller, does that only get imposed if the seller gives some kind of guaranteed conduct?
I didn't highlight that part of the Washington statute. And again, for purposes of kind of giving you the total picture of things, I think I did make some reference to the way in which the restatement, the restatement second approach, 402A, focused on sellers and said that it's the sale of the product that triggers this liability. I think the more modern approach, the restatement third, and is reflected in the Washington statute, focuses primarily on manufacturing the product. Now, there may be additional liability for sellers, like retailers of the product, particularly where the retailer has some independent basis of liability. They were negligent in the way they set up the product, or they dropped it when it, you know, they put it on the shelf, but they dropped it, and that's why the toaster doesn't, you know, work, or why it had a short and burned the house down. The seller may go out of their way to make some express warranty. This product is absolutely safe. It can't possibly, you know, you can't possibly get hurt using this product. Going beyond simply the question of is it reasonably safe to say, I guarantee it. In that situation where you make an express warranty, that's an independent basis for liability. But I wouldn't worry so much about that, except to note the way in which the law has changed from focusing on, this is not so much for purposes of the exam, but for purposes of kind of seeing the big picture here, that the law has shifted from focusing on the sale of the product as the thing that triggers liability to the manufacturer of a product that triggers liability with a kind of fallback position. Oh, by the way, you can go after the retailer if you need to. But that is a sort of second option rather than treating the retailer as though they're on the same par with people who manufacture the product.
Can the useful safe life of a product be stretched beyond 12 years?
Yes. And again, not all jurisdictions employ this statute of repose. So, you know, I bring up the statute of repose because some jurisdictions have introduced this idea and because the statute of repose has such a dramatic effect. It's not like contributory negligence that might reduce your recovery. If the statute of repose applies and your product is beyond the statute of repose, well, gee, that bars any claim whatsoever. So its significance is not because all jurisdictions use it, but because some do and it has a dramatic effect. Even within those jurisdictions that use the statute of repose, like Washington, you start out with this presumption. We just sort of give you, like a, you know, with your computer, you have a default setting, and you can go in and tweak that, where you say, no, I don't want this kind of starting point. I want to move this starting point someplace else. So again, a product like a, you know, Boeing 747 or, you know, some industrial machine that's built to last, you know, 20 or 30 years, the plaintiff can introduce evidence to say, we shouldn't use 12 years as the useful safe life. It ought to be 20 or 30 or 40 years. In a parallel way, the defendant could introduce evidence that for this particular product, a can of tuna fish, the useful safe life is a lot shorter than that, and the plaintiff shouldn't expect to be able to use it beyond, you know, X number of years after the product was sold. So, again, that's just a starting presumption, but if you had a case where you had a very old machine or product that injured the plaintiff, I would consider, gee, I wonder if the statute of repose is going to have an effect on this case.
Along the same lines,
There are two different issues. There are two different defenses a defendant can make. The statute of repose defense by the defendant says, I gave you the best years of my life. The product manufacturer says, I gave you a product. It performed safely within the period of time you could reasonably expect this product to perform. Beyond that, I accept no liability. And if the manufacturer is correct on that point, and the product did perform safely during its useful safe life, and the plaintiff continued to use it beyond that point, we say the manufacturer gave all we can ask them to give. There is an additional defense, the statute of limitations, which is the defendant saying, not just about product cases, but about any case, including product cases, the defendant says to the plaintiff, you waited too long after you were injured to get around to filing a claim. You sat on your rights, is the expression. And if you wait too long, the courts will look at you and say, you know, you had a window of opportunity there, and that window opened and that window closed. But again, it's two different concepts here. One concept is has nothing to do with how quickly the plaintiff got down to the courthouse. It has to do with whether the defendant gave what the defendant could be expected to do. I gave you a punch press that performed safely for 30 years. What more can you expect of me? The other concept is, plaintiff, you have to use reasonable diligence in filing a claim once you have that legal right. We don't want to be looking at cases 5, 10, 15 years after they occur. Now, obviously, we have exceptions to the rule, the discovery rule, and that sort of thing. But again, the statute of limitations has to do with how quickly the plaintiff responded once the plaintiff had the right to sue. Go ahead.
So then, with that case you had with the builder,
yes.
The statute of limitations, right?
Well, in a way, except what that statute did was to say, it was kind of a combo statute in the way. What it said was, whereas in most cases the statute of limitations begins to run when the plaintiff is in possession of all of the elements and has, you know, is dealing from a full deck, so to speak, and can then go down and file a claim. What that statute says is, with respect to construction claims, the statute of limitations begins to run. The cause of action accrues, and the claim begins to run the day the defendant lays his hammer down and the project is substantially complete. At that moment, 6 years begins to run. And you've got to bring a claim within those 6 years or you are barred. Regardless of when your injury occurred. And that's why Holly Pfeiffer says, oh, you mean I was supposed to file a claim before I fell off before I jumped off the third story of my burning building? That's pretty crazy. And again, the court had to figure, is that what the legislature really had in mind? In the sense that its purpose is to say to the defendant, you're on the hook for a limited period of time, and after that period of time has run, you can safely close your books and say, I don't have to worry about getting sued anymore. Remembering the part of the purpose of the statute of limitations is to give defendants a point at which they can dispose of their files and stop worrying that I'm going to have to come back and defend myself. Because someone's going to come out of the woodwork and say, oh, by the way, remember this surgery you performed 16 years ago? Remember this project that you built? I now want to hold you accountable for that. By the way, lawyers have the same issue where, for example, you write a will for somebody and the client comes to you and says, I want to leave all my money to so-and-so, and you write the will for them and you file this thing and, you know, it's all safely put away, and then 16 years later, the person dies. Now the will gets probated, and it turns out there's a problem. You messed up the tax implications, or, you know, the way you wrote the will, it doesn't go where the decedent apparently wanted the money to go, and typically it's the heirs, you know, the kids of the decedent, for example, who say, my mom told me she wanted all the money to go to such and so, and it turns out the way you wrote the will, it's now going to be contested and we're going to have to give half of it to so and so, and it's your fault. So the lawyer then has to defend, well, this is why I did what I did, and again, it has to do with what was done 15 years ago. For lawyers, we would say, so be it. There are also issues about who's entitled to sue. If you're doing work for your client's dead, but some beneficiary now claims, in effect, the work you did for your client is wrong, and the law basically permits people like that to sue, even though they're not your client. Anyway, the world of legal malpractice is sort of a world unto its own, but again, the same idea. Everybody would like at some point to not worry about someone showing up and say, oh, by the way, I want you to pay big bucks for something you did or one of your employees did years and years ago. And the legislature, again, has to balance the legitimate desire for people to be free of this threat, this cloud of litigation, against the notion, yeah, but what happens if, for example, you did mess up this will? And the first time you found out about the way in which you messed up that will is when you go to probate the estate, which is 16 years after the will was written. Are you saying that because it's been a long time, there's no remedy for that? So again, you got this balancing process you have to work out. And remember, just in estates of Hibbert, the way the court said, well, you know, the balancing that we would do with private parties is different from the balancing that we're going to do with the state. With respect to the state, we're going to put more emphasis upon the state's freedom from stale claims compared to our desire to provide remedies for people who, unbeknownst to them, got hurt by something the state did. Ms. Shoemaker. Yes. Right. This is very common. For example, in the asbestos cases, I'm working in the shipyards in 1950, and in the bowels of this ship, I'm sawing asbestos blankets and mixing up paste of asbestos cement. And, you know, unbeknownst to me, I get a dose of asbestos sufficient that in 1995, I exhibit signs of mesothelioma. The doctor diagnoses me and says, I have terrible news for you. You got mesothelioma and you're going to be dead in 6 months. If the manufacturer says, wait a minute, this is barred by the statute of repose. It's 45 years since we made this product. Well, we'd have to analyze that issue from the standpoint of did the product perform safely during its useful safe life? And the answer is how quickly, you know, the product was made in 1949, the product caused injury, in effect, in 1950, got into his lungs in 1950, that's a useful safe life of 1 year. Now, it might be different if I put asbestos into the ceiling tiles, because it's sort of like a reinforcing, like using a steel-reinforced concrete. You put asbestos because it's fibrous, and it has these sort of... anyway, they're asbestos used to be used in linoleum, ceiling tiles, etc. I put that into a school in 1950. Some construction worker is tearing it out and gets this disease in 1995. Then I've got a useful safe life issue. But again, the useful safe life question is, how soon after you made the product did it cause the injury? Did it perform for 45 years safely, or, in fact, immediately after it was sold, it got into this guy's lungs, lurking there to kill him later? Secondly, with respect to the statute of limitations, that's a separate question. The statute of limitations question is, how quickly did the plaintiff respond to, gee, I have a lawsuit? And the defendant could hardly say to the plaintiff, well, in 1952, when you were still young and vigorous, you should have filed a claim. We saw that in the Carter case, remember? Carter tried to sue after he'd been exposed to asbestos and say, I may get cancer someday, and the court said, no, this is way too soon. Let's wait and find out if you get it or not. When you get it, if you get it, we'll deal with you then. So the plaintiff waiting until he has symptoms of the disease would be a reasonable, you know, that's when he knew or should have known of his claim and the right to sue. There are asbestos cases in which a person is actually diagnosed with asbestosis. The doctor will write in the patient's medical chart, you know, patient presented himself complained of symptoms of shortness of breath, you know, after taking patient's history, preliminary diagnosis is asbestosis, recommendation, occasional oxygen therapy, blah, 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 blah. Patient's diagnosed with asbestosis. Does that start the running of the statute of limitations? When it first occurs, it's just shortness of breath. And, by the way, he smoked for 20 years. Should he then have run down to the nearest law firm and said, please file a claim against the asbestos manufacturers? Did he know or reasonably know of the harm and its cause? Those turn out to be much more difficult questions, but again, for your purposes, you want to make sure you understand the difference between a statute of repose that says I only have to manufacture a product that is safe for a reasonable period of time, and if after performing safely all these many years, it later gets involved in some kind of injury, I can't be held responsible in perpetuity. That's the statute of repose argument. The statute of limitations argument is the plaintiff had good reason to go down and file a claim, and the plaintiff just sat around and said, I'll get to it. That's the statute of limitations defense, and it depends upon essentially how quickly the plaintiff acted and whether the plaintiff at what point in time, as the Watergate testimony or whatever made famous, you know, what did he know and when did he know it? That's the statute of limitations question. At what point did the plaintiff have the kind of knowledge that would have made a reasonable person pursue that kind of a claim? And oftentimes you can't tell it from the facts. You don't know enough about from the facts how soon the plaintiff was aware of this and whether the plaintiff's behavior was that of a reasonable person. The jury, that the question about whether the plaintiff used reasonable diligence is a question for the jury, unless, you know, the judge says, gee, reasonable minds couldn't differ. But again, if I go to my doctor writes something in my medical chart, I don't even see my medical chart. Maybe he told me I had this, maybe he didn't, I can't remember. That's a much more sympathetic case to the plaintiff than when the doctor gives him a recommendation. You know, I'd like you to fill this prescription, and I'd also like you to make an appointment with Snerd, Snidely, and Whiplash to, investigate, filing a claim. Then, you know, the plaintiff's on notice. It's time to look at your legal remedies.
Concerning liability to a child.
Yes, liability to a child.
To a child. If we're in a jurisdiction that permits the allocation of fault to the new party,
okay,
you know, and decreasing the share that the other defendants have to pay, is the new party, say, the parents, are they still off the damages?
Well, again, the immunity issue is separate from the allocation of fault issue. It's not that they're complete, I should say, is distinct from, not necessarily separate from. Chris, where is that? Okay. With respect to the parents would say, if the claim involves negligent parenting, failure to perform the parenting duties in a reasonable way, the parents would say, I'm immune as to that. Again, you want to ask the question, is there some basis for saying this individual owed a duty to this plaintiff irrespective of the parenting relationship? So, for example, if Junior is helping Dad in the carpentry shop and Dad fails to supervise the kid as the kid pushes some wood through the table saw and loses a finger. Is this a negligent parenting claim, or is this a negligent table saw operator claim? such that you could say, irrespective of the relationship, parent-child, I don't need that. I could simply say a reasonable person operating a table saw wouldn't ask somebody, oh yeah, take a quarter inch off of that thing without warning this person, oh, by the way, you got it, you can't, you know, so forth and so on. Make sure your sleeve doesn't get caught in the teeth as they're going past. So, again, if I can make that as an ordinary negligence claim, not one of negligent parenting, then I'm going to say parental immunity doesn't apply. But supposing it does, if parental immunity applies, the other defendants may still say this person should be allocated a share of fault. Part of this accident is a result of the negligence of this parent. They're immune, but it's still partially their fault, and I want to have fault allocated to them because it helps me as a defendant in limiting my liability.
That's what I said. This helps them not they pay, but the parents still don't have to
pay. And then I have to look at the statute and try to figure out, well, what does my statute tell me? Does my statute say, for example, every entity responsible for the plaintiff's injury should be allocated a percentage of fault? Well, that's pretty good language for the defendant. On the other hand, if it says every party to the suit has to be allocated a share of fault, that means I can only allocate fault among the people who are parties to the suit. And I can't make the parent a party where the parent is immune. Well, that's not good for the defendant. Again, this is a pretty technical thing, fairly far down in the level of detail. But if you're getting there and it's important to you, this is the way you kind of track the thing and say, well, can I get any leverage? Can I get any guidance from this statute? Does the statute seem to lean in a direction that favors the plaintiff, in which case I want to point this out to my client? Does it lean in favor of the defendant? Similarly, I'd make note of this. Or is this something where, gee, maybe it says it, maybe it doesn't, but I can't tell and I got other stuff to do? So, again, here again, I guess I want to be clear about what I'm telling you, not that you shouldn't care about these details. These are precisely the kinds of details that can help you help your client. But I would say that rather than having a snappy answer to all of them, oh, here's what you do here and here's what you do there, look at the way in which you can kind of reason your way from what you know to what you don't know and shed more light in this area to your client's benefit, or maybe not. I don't know how this thing turns out. And I don't have time to track it down because I got other stuff I got to do. That's a perfectly reasonable, in fact, in many cases, necessary approach. You have to resist the temptation to follow every rabbit down every little rabbit hole. You got to keep your eye on the big picture here and cover as many issues in the level of depth that you think most advances the cause of your client. The cause of your client being, I want to know, how likely is it they're going to hit me and how bad? Or how likely is it I can hit somebody else, pull that handle on the slot machine and have a bunch of nickels spilling out onto the floor. Jones.
Secondary unreasonable assumption of risk.
Yes.
You say it acts has the same effect as contributory
right.
Fault. Is that true?
It acts the same as contributory negligence. So, just so we have our okay. Terminology here, I use the term contributory fault as the sort of inclusive term, just as fault is the inclusive term used in the Uniform Comparative Fault Act, used in the Washington statute about, fault defined. Fault's this sort of generic thing that includes strict liability and negligence and breach of warranty and all these different things. In a similar way, contributory fault is the, remembering, contributory refers to plaintiffs. It's a term of art that means plaintiff's fault, and that includes the two varieties here, contributory negligence, as well as assumption of risk. And what you were saying is that that form of assumption of risk, which is unreasonable behavior, getting into a car with an impaired driver, crossing the street when it's too busy, that form of unreasonable assumption of risk is the same thing as contributory negligence.
So that would also act as a bar in jurisdictions that have a modified...
If it exceeds a certain threshold, yes. And again, what you would want to say, for example, if in your fact pattern the plaintiff does something like, for example, somebody says, hey, I'm not sure you want to use that drill. It's, jumped out of my hand the last time something was out of balance or something. And the plaintiff says, what the heck? I just need it for a little while here. You could say that's assumption of risk, the voluntary assumption of a known risk. But what is that? If anything, it is simply contributory negligence. It is not as though, it's not like sitting in an unscreened baseball seat. It's not the choice of using drills that have this, vibrator feature to them. Nor is it this, Kirk versus Washington State, similarly where there's a mixture of sort of thrill-seeking behavior on the one hand and negligence on the other. There's no reason to even talk about assumption of risk. What the plaintiff did in that case is contributory negligence. Once we're at that point, the jury would be instructed on contributory negligence. I'm quite confident in that fact pattern that you would simply have an instruction on contributory negligence, and then the jury would decide, is this equal to or greater than the defendant's fault? And again, according to the comparative fault statute, it may be, under those circumstances, a bar to recovery. So even though the product is defective because the plaintiff's fault is, fits the criterion under which it is barred. And again, I don't know that from looking at the facts. I can only, this is a possibility, but again, trying to help your client anticipate what is this claim worth if there's a possibility that despite proving the product was defective, I hire all these expensive experts and they testify about the way drills are constructed and we, do all this stuff and I prove this product is defective, yippee. Despite that, if the jury finds my fault is equal to or greater than that of the defendant, I get nothing. If that's the rule in this jurisdiction, my client deserves to know that. It reduces the overall value of this case because of the risk that despite all this effort, I could be skunked. Again, as distinguished from, in this jurisdiction, it's a pure comparative fault rule. Even if they found that your use of this drill after being told about its problems was negligent, so they find you 70% negligent, you still get 30% of your damages. That's a very different outcome, puts me in a different frame of mind than saying, so long as they find their negligence is greater than yours, you still recover, but if your negligence is equal to or greater than that of the defendant, you lose. Again, that's a very valuable piece of information. It's a very scary piece of information if you're the plaintiff or the plaintiff's lawyer. Ms. Townsend.
How far does an inherent
Well, I think you're talking about assumption of risk, right?
Right.
Okay. So when I climb on a Southwest Air, when I climb on the Southwest Airlines flight, they don't have an assumption of risk defense, and I like the idea, it's not my idea, it's actually Guido Calabresi's idea, that assumption of risk corresponds to abnormally dangerous activities. That getting on an airplane is not an abnormally dangerous activity. Skydiving is an abnormally dangerous activity. And only really crazy people go skydiving. If it falls into one of those cases where it is, but then, as you say, you got to figure out, well, what's the inherent risk of skydiving? So let's say I take somebody skydiving. I'm the defendant in the case. I take them skydiving, and you turn the light on and say, okay, everybody jump now. And they jump out and somebody gets hurt in the process, I can say, well, that's the inherent risk of skydiving. You jump out of an airplane and sometimes bad things happen. By contrast, I may do something that's not part of the inherent risk, but actually creates a new risk. I negligently, instead of holding the plane straight and level, I'm trying to make a turn while I tell people to jump out of the airplane. That's not part of the inherent risk of skydiving. That's not something that is just there because that's what you do when you're skydiving. That's an act of negligence distinct from the inherent risk. Just exactly like Kirk versus Washington State. The inherent risk of pyramid stunts is these guys hold me up above the astroturf, and the inherent risk is that I lose my balance and I fall down and I hurt myself. But there is an enhanced risk when you don't give me a chance to practice this on wrestling mats before we go out and do our stunts. There's an enhanced risk where I'm trying to figure it out myself instead of having a coach who goes around and says, okay, do this, do this, do this. So what Kathleen Kirk said, and the court agreed, was you can't blame this on the inherent risk. There's an additional risk resulting from the defendant's negligence, and the court says, we think the jury should allocate. To the extent it's the inherent risk, nothing more than the nature of the activity, no recovery. To the extent there's an enhanced risk, negligent conduct by the defendant, that the plaintiff can recover for. And the jury made that allocation. And I say, good for them. Not all courts, as I've said before, have, not even the Washington Court of Appeals, which originally, put this stuff together, won't even follow their own rule consistently, at least as I see it. So again, this whole area is full of confusion, and I wouldn't be too quick to say, oh, well, this is the way you diagram and map it out. I'd say, that's why I'd like to do it, but the court may go this other way, and I would certainly ask myself the question, is it within the realm of possibility that a court could take this a different way and the plaintiff or the defendant would wind up getting screwed by that? For lack of a better term. Yeah. Darker's.
Yeah, I'm just wondering,
I don't think you can simplify it to that point. First of all, because I'm not sure I would necessarily agree with all of that, but even if I did agree with it and say, yes, that's a perfectly sensible way to do it, one of the things you have to be aware of is in this area, courts don't always think this through. They may sort of instinctively say, as we've seen, courts may say, ah, the plaintiff voluntarily assumed a known risk, claim is barred. I'm up there jumping up and down saying, no, there's a part of this that the plaintiff accepted, but there's another part that resulted from the defendant's negligence. You ought to do this just like Kirk versus Washington State. Scuba diving case. Student who drowns because allegedly the instructor failed to provide supervision in this dive in Coeur d'Alene Lake, that's just like Kirk versus Washington State. I think it is. The court didn't think so. They said you voluntarily assumed a known risk. Nobody held a gun to your head and said you have to go scuba diving. It's a free country. You can sign something that says, I agree this is, you know, my responsibility and won't hold these people liable for negligence. We'll enforce that. Nothing to the plaintiff. No trial, no nothing. I want to advise my client that that's a possibility. Even though I would say there's a better way to handle it. So again, as you try to kind of come up with how do I differentiate these different types, good for you, I'm with you. At the same time, we want to say, gee, if I'm the defendant, I'm going to argue that it bars the claim. And maybe the court will do it and maybe they won't. We've seen examples of them going both ways.
Under the joint and several liability in the mixed system, how does the plaintiff's percentage of fault work?
Okay. You got a situation where you think a jury would, at least it's a distinct possibility, that the jury's going to allocate fault as between plaintiff, defendant, and the other defendant. Let's say the allocation of fault looks like this. What you want to do is go look at the statute and say, okay, if it's like this, what effect? Particularly if this person turns out to be a drunk driver, let's say, or you know, here's the product manufacturer that sold the product, it's got a defect in it, the doors don't lock, preventing the plaintiff from being ejected from the car, but the collision's caused by a drunk driver, plaintiff got into the car with the drunk driver, plaintiff's partially at fault, car's defective, driver's significantly at fault. That's the way I think the jury's going to allocate this. Suppose this person has very limited assets, and this is Ford Motor Company, General Motors. I then want to read the statute to say what is the liability of Defendant 1. If I'm the plaintiff, I want to say Defendant 1 is liable for 90% of my damages. If I'm the defendant, I want to say my liability is limited to 30% of my damages. And the legislature's got to choose. And hopefully from this statute, the comparative fault statute, you can evaluate. In this jurisdiction, the plaintiff gets whatever damages the jury assigns less their share of fault. Or you can evaluate and say, this jurisdiction, as the one we saw in Idaho says, unless it's a pharmaceutical drug or hazardous waste or some other, you know, case that doesn't apply, the defendant's liability is limited to the share assigned to them by the jury. Now, many jurisdictions vary the outcome according to whether this is zero or some number greater than zero. such that, for example, in Washington, a plaintiff assigned 0% of fault is entitled to a full recovery. Whereas a plaintiff found to be partially at fault gets no benefit from joint and several liability. Other jurisdictions will say this reallocation business, where we kind of split the difference with respect to joint and several liability. Again, there are all sorts of different variations on that theme, and you want to go to those statutes, as I hope you're doing as you look at past exams, and just, you know, see how well you're doing as you look up the comparative fault features of the statute attached to the exam and say, I read this statute to mean such and so. What does DeWolf think? How close did I come to correctly evaluating the treatment in this jurisdiction of the question of joint and several liability? And as I say, the plaintiff's fault is often a deciding factor in whether or not the plaintiff gets joint and several liability, but in Idaho, it's not. A fault-free plaintiff in Idaho gets treated the same way as a plaintiff at fault in Idaho. None of them gets joint and several liability. It's defendant's paradise. In California, by contrast, the plaintiff's fault doesn't matter for purposes of joint and several liability. The defendant pays whatever the plaintiff is entitled to. The damages minus the plaintiff's percentage of fault. It's plaintiff's paradise. But many places like Washington are paradise for no one. They're a little bit of, you know, they're a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Mr. Ortiz? That's a strategic possibility, very definitely. I would say that would fall into that realm, which is after I make an accurate assessment of where this thing is going, and in particular, after we begin, you know, a more in-depth, you know, further down the road, those are the kinds of things that very much will show up on our horizon. Because there's so many things you have to kind of project in order to get to that point of a preemptive settlement, I would say, before you get there, lay the problem out. But you've illustrated why it's so important to know this. The defendant who knows in advance, I'm potentially liable for the whole thing. Even if you're not in California, if you're in Washington, but you look at the plaintiff is not an adult who got into a car with an impaired driver. The plaintiff is the occupant of another car that was struck when the drunk driver in a defective car left the highway, crossed the median, and whacked into the plaintiff's not going to be assigned a percentage of fault. In Washington, they're entitled to joint and several liability. My client needs to know that as the defendant, so that then they can begin to say, well, what compared to worst case scenario might be a more attractive, you know? We need to start reaching into our wallet and figuring out how much we can pay on this claim, as compared to being in Idaho where you say, okay, so our car was defective. What's the jury going to blame us for? 20% of the accident? That's the worst case scenario. They say we're 20% of fault, we pay 20% of the damage. So again, that's precisely the kind of information that I think is so critical that you want to put way high up on your priority list of the things I want to know and I want to communicate accurately to my client compared to the second and third order stuff, which is if this and that and that, then we might consider such and so. Yes.
Died,
Yes.
And then OD and
OD. Right. Okay. It's the parts of this are, I think I may have mentioned this before, the case. The rape part of the case is a real case that happened in Washington State. Washington State was the defendant. And the question about whether the university was liable, what her status was, all this kind of stuff. Also, the Tarasoff issues in the case about whether they had a duty to warn, etc. Then I made up the part about the rape leading to this birth. Okay. Now, your question was, how is it that that would generate both a wrongful birth and a wrongful life? First question is this a garden variety medical malpractice or product liability firm? No, it is not a case in which the student was planning to have a baby, but through the defendant's negligence, she had a baby who had birth defects. That would be a garden variety medical malpractice case. This is a case in which the defendant's negligence resulted in the birth of a child who wouldn't have been born but for the defendant's negligence. That suddenly triggers all the wrongful birth, wrongful life questions. You'll recall, going way back to the earliest part of what we covered this semester, post-midterm, wrongful birth is the label we give to the claim by the parents. The parents say, I've been injured because you gave me a baby I didn't want. And again, we have all these policy good views. That's kind of a, you really want to say that? Okay, but the law says, particularly with respect to kids who are born with handicaps, that a wrongful birth kind of claim is okay. You can bring a claim like that. The wrongful life claim is brought where you have a seriously handicapped child, just like Harbison, who says, but for your negligence, I wouldn't have all these problems. But for your negligence, I wouldn't be here. But, oh, by the way, but for your negligence, I wouldn't have all these problems. And the question is, will the court recognize such a wrongful life claim, and how will they calculate the damages? Those courts that do allow a wrongful life claim would likely limit it to the out-of-pocket expenses, not including some sort of pain and suffering award to the child for wrongful life. Striker.
That's more or less
the same event gives rise to different claims by different plaintiffs. In the same way, in Dillon versus Legg, you have the wrongful death claim for the dead child. You have the bystander claim for the sister who's in the crosswalk. You have the bystander claim for the mother who's on the porch. And again, you have multiple plaintiffs, each lining up at the cashier's window saying, this event damaged us in different ways. Richard Rodriguez, pie falls on him, but Marianne Rodriguez shows up, says, I got claims of my own. So again, in those situations, a single injury can generate multiple plaintiffs who say, I deserve a piece of this too. Yeah?
How much damages are we supposed to hand out, or are we just supposed to...
I'm trying to limit... more than... That's too weak... a statement. On the exam, I will not want you to cover the same ground we had in the midterm about how you calculate damages. I don't know exactly how I'm going to figure in, you know, how I can segregate the part we didn't cover from the part we did cover in Chapter 3, but my advice to you is, to the extent it's something already covered on the midterm exam, I don't want to cover that ground again. That applies throughout the exam. There are times when I simply can't figure a way around it But even then, I will do stuff like, say, your partner has assessed the damages at $1 million, but your partner wants you to work up the liability case. What's your analysis? So again, I'll try to steer you away from repeating stuff we've already covered. At the same time, I may throw in a wrongful birth kind of question to be able to test you on that. Yeah, all that kind of stuff that we did in the first part of Chapter 3, you know, I'm not going to throw in a punitive damages issue. I'm not going to throw in a, you know, discounting for economic investment opportunities that, you know. I don't want to do any wrongful deaths. I've been there, done that. So if I do that, I will either say, yeah, it happened to be wrong, like, that's part of the fact, but I'll give you a number. So instead of saying, well, in a wrongful death case, it's based on a statutory recovery, but again, you should be looking, where is DeWolf directed me away from that issue, because I thought we already covered that, and I'm not... although I'm prepared to address it in some abstract sense, I know I have other things he wants me to spend time on, and that's where I want to be going.
Can you address when a special relationship arises and who is responsible for the relationship?
Okay. Remember that special relationship is a term used by the court to provide an exception for the ordinary rule that I am not my brother's keeper. That if somebody's in peril and needs help, ordinarily as a legal matter, I can walk on by and ignore it. I may be a rotten human being, but I'm not legally liable for failing to help somebody who's in peril. If I didn't create the problem, I don't have a legal duty to solve it. However, the courts say, well, that's not entirely true. There are times when the relationship between the defendant and the plaintiff is such that you do have a duty to rescue them or to do something to reduce their peril. If I'm tending bar, you know, I'm, what's his name, Ted Danson, you know, at Cheers, and one of my customers is pouring out his troubles and expresses to me, you know, Podar and Titania fashion about some nefarious thing this person is going to do, does Ted, you know, what's his name?
Sam Malone
have a legal obligation to pick up the phone and say, gee, I just had a guy in my bar who I think is up to no good. Warn the, you know, he kept talking about his girlfriend or his wife or, you know, his business partner, something like that, and I think this person is in deep trouble. If he fails to do that, could you sue him? Is he like the psychiatrist in Tarasov? I don't think so. There is no special relationship. One of the things the court said in Tarasov is there is a special relationship when the patient discloses to the psychiatrist about the intent to do harm to a specific individual, where there is a legal duty, an enforceable legal duty, to treat the patient and sort of the stuff that goes with it. Again, the court's making a policy decision to recognize a special relationship and this is an exception to our ordinary rule. And again, the courts are going to be reluctant to push that rule all out of boundaries, but they may say there are times, you know, when you are your brother's keeper. And we think, as a matter of public policy, whatever that expression was, the confidentiality ends where the public peril begins, or something like that. Now, I don't think the courts are going to impose it on Sam Malone or other bartenders, regardless of the lurid stuff they hear as they're, you know, pouring this guy another drink. I don't think they're going to apply it to cab drivers. Will they apply it to school counselors? Again, that was part of the issue in the Washington State case, that the guy was identified previously as a troubled individual in the counseling service, sort of like Tara saw, and they didn't warn her about his criminal intentions. And the court may say, gee, there's a duty there. Ms. Peterson. Again. Yeah, but again, the courts are schizophrenic here as well, thinking, gee, if suddenly the police officers are more worried about lawsuits instead of using their best judgment about how to provide the maximum degree of security to the maximum number of people, they're worried about the trial lawyers breathing down their neck. For every mistake, they start practicing defensive police work as doctors complain they're forced to practice defensive medicine. That's bad public policy. So again, anytime you do this special relationship or its cousin, the idea of justifiable reliance, wherever you use that to create liability on the part of someone who's in a helping role, the courts are going to weigh the benefits to the plaintiff, the expectation, society's expectation of this defendant, against the notion, well, where is this leading? Are we sure this is going to make us better off? Or by forcing psychiatrists to narc on their patients, will people stop going to psychiatrists? So, again, I would be very sensitive if I had a case like this to say how the court comes out on this is not simply a function of the facts in my case, it's a function of the court's read of the public policy implications for imposing or not imposing liability. Got it? No. Well, that's a legal duty. In other words, I already have a duty, unlike a stranger walking by a two-year-old face down in the puddle, a parent walking by his own child face down in a puddle can be put in jail for murder, actually, if I don't pick my child out of that. I have a legal, enforceable duty to protect the interests of my child. Right. Yeah, I do know what you're talking about. I remember it well. Again, the question that would arise in your mind is there a legal duty here? In the fact that, for those of you who haven't read that, the middle-aged couple take their elderly parent to a state park. Elderly parent gets in the lake and drowns. The question would be, did they owe a duty to their elderly parent? If it were, you know, parent with child, the question would be an obvious yes. But with respect to an elderly parent, I don't know. So the first question I ask is there a legal duty that's owed? Did the father, in fact, justifiably rely on the children to take care of him? Did that generate a duty? Or in the alternative, would we say there's a special relationship? Anytime, I mean, you might say as a matter of public policy, anytime you take a person who needs your assistance, you don't have to take them to the state park for how nice of you to do that. You don't have to do that. It's sort of like the government and the lighthouse. You don't have to build a lighthouse, but if you build the lighthouse and people start to rely on that, you better come through. You can't simply say, oh, I'm a nice guy, and you can't nail me for being a nice guy. There is justifiable reliance. There is a special relationship. Again, that would be the analysis day. I wonder how that would work. And in an analogous way, would there be some sort of parental immunity? I don't think so. It's not a parental relationship here. again, I mean, in that case, the primary defendant was the state. The question is, was the state negligent in failing to warn about this peril in the water? And they, in turn, would like to say, even if you find us to be at fault, which of course requires all the sovereign immunity analysis and premise of liability and all this kind of stuff, in addition to that, the state would like to offload some of its liability to the middle-aged couple. And can they do that? Is there a basis for assigning them a share of fault? Do they owe a duty? That's where you got to analyze that and come to some conclusion. Assuming they did owe a duty and that they were found to have breached that duty, how would that play in the comparative fault statute? What's the rule with respect to that in this case? I don't want to push anybody's... if the espresso you had this morning is working in on your system, but my inclination is just to keep going here, I guess. And if you need to go, go. But I'm going to keep going here. Mr. Nelson, right? Gordon, I'm sorry.
An injured party
can refuse to take the money, but typically they don't have a choice as to whether they're in the system or not. The system is set up to be a kind of, you know, good news, bad news trade-off, and the trade-off is not, if the plaintiff always had the option, I can either choose this no-fault recovery, or I can choose an ordinary tort measure of damages, the employer would get the worst of both worlds. Where the plaintiff was at fault, or the employer wasn't at fault, they choose the no-fault recovery, where they, you know, so again, most systems are set up that you take the bitter with the sweet. You're in the system, whether you like it or not. And therefore, it's reduced. Your remedies, if it falls within the workers' comp system, are governed by that. Now, I did give an exam, just the one I gave in the spring, involving a real case in which it was like the Berklett versus Boeing case of an egregious overreach by the employer to force the employee back into a known dangerous environment. And I wanted the students to say, well, wait a minute, there is an exception for intentionally caused injury, and maybe this would fall within the intentional injury exception. Some people got that, some people didn't. But most of the time, if it's not an intentionally caused injury, hey buddy, you either get back on that ladder or you're fired. In the absence of that, and even that might not be enough, but in the absence of that, it's just an ordinary workplace injury caused by negligent whatever, the employer's immune, even if the employee would like to say, hey, in this case, I'll give you my puny workers' comp benefits back so that I can, you know, that would be an unworkable system. You're in it whether you like it or not in the vast majority of jurisdictions. Some have this optional election feature, but employers would scream bloody murder quite justifiably, that they shouldn't have to get the worst of whatever the employee chooses as the better way to go.
Could you explain a cross-claim?
Well, yeah, this makes more sense in a, you know, where you've been doing a lot of procedural stuff. The idea of a cross-claim is that it's this party against that party. I've got a claim by the plaintiff, but then I have a cross-claim from one defendant to another, typically for contribution. So when you see that language in an opinion, or you see that, I may have used that in the course of explaining a sample answer, that the defendant would file a cross-claim against the other defendant for contribution. That would, or it may be in the statute where it says a defendant can cross-claim for contribution or something like that. But again, the typical way, and different procedural systems use different terms. California uses this term cross-complaint for some reason. But again, it's from one defendant to another. Mr. Lynch. Yes. As of today, I have tried to do that. And again, since you don't know the limitations period in the jurisdiction that you're in, you won't know whether it's a big deal that it's been 2 years or it's been 3.5 years or whatever. On the other hand, if it's been 10 years, then you would want to say, gee, the only way I could file this claim is if the discovery rule applies or something like that. So, but again, assume for purposes that occasionally I screw this up, but I try not to, take the case, change the dates so that it would happen as of August 1, 2003. So that client walked into your office on August 1, 2003. You don't have to know anything. It's a very interesting historical anomaly, and I actually covered in one of my articles. I think it's the article on several liability. No, I think actually it's in the article on assumption risk, where I actually talk about last clear channel. But I would ignore it. The only thing you need to know about it is occasionally the only place where it really would help you to know about it is many times the comparative fault statute will say, as the court did in Lee versus Yellow Cab, by the adoption of comparative negligence, we hereby abolish the doctrine of last clear chance. And the sum and substance of last clear chance was it was a workaround for the harshness of the contributory negligence rule. There were some cases where a plaintiff could recover even though the plaintiff had been negligent because the defendant had the last clear chance. But the doctrine was a mess from the beginning, and that's why it's very interesting to go back and read about it. The key case is this guy who tethers his donkey, and then the donkey gets run over. And so, it's just, but for another day, someday when you have nothing better to do, you should go back and read all that stuff and amuse yourselves. Yes. Right.
Is there a key to knowing when they actually mean only if?
Ooh, that's an interesting question.
It happens in the 5 criteria for
Oh, I see. Not so much in a statute. But more likely in something like the restatement. Yeah, the restatement should be written in a pretty clear way. It's most common for these to be written in the conjunctive, that they all must be met. I'm trying to think of cases where the most common place where they're written in the alternative, or at least in a sort of non-conjunctive way, is the would be the criteria for an abnormal and dangerous activity, which we're done with. But most of the others are essentially A, B, and C must be met to satisfy this criterion. Correct. Now, again, you may have court opinions like Dillon versus Legg that say whether a bystander ought to recover is a function of three criteria, presence of the accident scene, directness of the emotional shock, etc. But I would, you know, that again, those kinds of things are scattered hither and thither. When you're reading a statute, I would also keep as just as a way of testing your own understanding, just kind of running it through a common sense. Does this sound like a logical thing someone would want? And if it doesn't sound like a logical thing someone would want, then I say, you know, it says add 1 cup of salt. Wait a minute, you know, that's a lot of salt for a cake recipe or something. Maybe they meant sugar. Maybe you're I'm misreading that abbreviation. So again, filtering your understanding of this through some, how likely is it that this would be the sort of thing the legislature would want? Sometimes that is exactly what they want. You read the Idaho statute and you say, are you saying me that plaintiffs never get the benefit of joint several liability except for these isolated cases? Yeah, that's exactly what they mean. So it can be that you got to follow the thing. Yeah, this is sauerkraut chocolate cake. Strangely enough, there is such a thing. Okay, you know, but again, before you simply copy that down, you would say, am I misreading something? Is this really what this is saying? And oftentimes you'll find, oh, I misread this, or there's another provision that seems to be saying something very different. And again, I just want to make a note of the fact that this doesn't sound quite right to me. Mr. Sarpris. Yes, although even within that, you know, I edit the statutes somewhat, but it's not to say that every provision of the statute applies to this case. There may be long passages that have to do with negotiable instruments drawn on state, you know, banking establishments or something, or say, yeah, this doesn't do me any good. So as we practiced in Chapter 6, kind of using the headings as indicators, is there something in this provision that is relevant to my case? You may have stuff that doesn't, that you can, in effect, skim over, as opposed to finding the place where, ooh, this is the important part that tells me about modified versus pure comparative fault, or the rule of joint several liability, or the circumstances under which the state will be held liable, or caps on liability, or, you know, provisions that affect my particular case. So, yes, the statutes address either sovereign immunity or comparative fault, but within that, you may get some aspects of the statute that you say, gee, I don't see what this is doing in here. And the fact that it's in there doesn't mean I had some expectation that you were going to utilize this to your client's benefit. I may have wanted to slow you down so you'd spend less time writing. Other questions? Mr. Campbell.
Just a question about this good faith hearing under the $7 million deduction. Can you explain?
Okay. The first thing, again, sort of identifying where this fits in my overall strategic plan here. Good faith settlement hearings are a provision of jurisdictions who employ a dollar method of reduction. Whereas the and this is for in the case of settlement. And again, settlement only shows up on your radar screen where something about the case suggests that settlement is in the is on the horizon here. I wouldn't go out of your way to talk about settlement if there isn't some suggestion that that's an item of more kind of immediate concern to your client. Okay, but if you say that part of the question has to do with an offer of settlement or you know, preparing a settlement offer or something like that, if you're in a jurisdiction that, as far as you can tell, employs a dollar method, frequently that will be contingent on, the reduction is contingent on some kind of good faith settlement process. So again, I'm in a jurisdiction where there are two defendants, one of whom settles, one does not, and the rule appears to be that if defendant one, if defendant two gives the plaintiff $10,000, that reduces the plaintiff's claim against defendant one by $10,000, as opposed to reducing it by the percentage of fault. To protect defendant one from the injustice of paying 95-98% of the liability when they're only 30% at fault, the jurisdiction will do as California did and say such agreements are only effective where this settlement is found to be in good faith. So there's some protection to the defendant, but as we saw, the standard of what good faith is creates enough ambiguity that I'm not sure exactly how that would play out. So again, this is the kind of thing where if you were in that situation, I needed, you know, to know something about that, but how much of this can I deliver to my client to be of practical value to them? And I should spend more of my time in those areas where I can deliver something that's a little cleaner, a little bit more direct, has a little more tangible value. Yes.
I guess my question is, where do you draw the line between a professional and the person who indicates that they have a reliance?
Good question.
If you have a doctor, or if you have a lawyer, or if you have an accountant, so it seems to be the professional negligence standard, but say, in one of your patents, you have a pilot, and it seems like a pilot would have some sort of additional knowledge that would induce justifiable reliance, but could you count them as
I can't remember off the top of my head. What was the pilot case connected to a justifiable reliance issue?
The pilot was an amateur pilot. Well, a professional. I mean, he was flying for a company, and it had to do with like a radar screen or something like that.
And he crashes,
and
right?
He crashes.
Now, there, I don't think vis-a-vis the pilot. See, the pilot's doesn't raise any justifiable reliance issues because it's the pilot's negligence that causes the crash. So, as distinguished from a case in which the person can say, I am not my brother's keeper, the pilot is the one who caused the crash. It's a sin of commission. I flew this plane into a mountain, as distinguished from I didn't do enough to help rescue this person from peril. Now, vis-a-vis the air traffic control, the question would be, am I my pilot's keeper? You know, is it my job to protect people from crashing into mountains? And there, I think you have a very strong case of justifiable reliance. Not only do I justifiably rely on air traffic control, they'll shoot me down if I don't, you know, I mean, if I don't respond to air traffic control, you know, I'm in big trouble. So So unlike a situation in which you have, oh yeah, we provide weather reports for those who are interested, air traffic control, more than simply, gee, we're a helpful thing there in case you happen to need us, they directly control things. Now, like the FDA, at the same time, you would say, to what extent is the sovereign immunity, we got the duty of care issue. Did they owe a duty of care? And I would think that's a relatively, yeah, of course, air traffic control owes a duty of care. On the other hand, they may say, but look at the sovereign immunity issues. Is this a discretionary function? You know, does it fall within some area in which the government has held off liability, limited its liability? So, again, the pilot, I would think, would be subject to an ordinary standard of reasonable, you know, reasonable, whatever the standard of care is for pilots, reasonable care. Not so much a professional negligence. I would think of professional negligence having to do with sort of the learned professions, you know, architecture, law, medicine, etc., as distinguished from something like being a pilot, where there are obviously standards, but there are standards for whatever. That, yeah. Other questions? Stubbs?
I just had a question last time when we were doing some tests. When a medical malpractice suit arises and deciding who to bring the claim against, you bring it against the hospital or the doctor or both?
Good question. And it's something we didn't talk about, so I'm glad you asked it. As it turns out, doctors are not employees of hospitals. You'd sort of think in the relationship, big institution, person working in the institution, there's a kind of vicarious liability relationship. It turns out, for various kinds of reasons, that doctors have an independent status. The hospitals, actually, the hospitals do employ some people. Some hospitals employ anesthesiologists. They're on staff, and that's a typical kind of vicarious liability relationship. But the surgeon typically comes into the hospital as an independent contractor, and the hospital doesn't control the way its typical independent contractor doesn't have the right to control, the doctor controls the way the work is done. So the doctor, the surgeon, and the hospital are two different defendants. And sometimes it's difficult to figure out, as we go back to Ibarra versus Spangard, something bad happens during the course of surgery. Was that the nurse's fault, the hospital employee's fault, or was it the doctor's fault? Those are two different defendants. As a practical matter, they all tend to have plenty of dough. So to the extent that you identified, oh, I think this person was negligent, the fact that you ascribed it to this person rather than that person wouldn't be of all that much interest. The important thing is, how likely is it that I can establish that there was negligence or failure to provide or secure informed consent?
So like in the test I was doing last night, the nurse and the hospital itself were pretty negligent, and the doctor itself. So the nurse, you could bring a case against the hospital because of the nurse?
Yeah, and again, I wouldn't worry. This is sort of a distinctly second or third order issue about exactly who writes the check. What would be significant for your analytical purposes would be, can I identify something the doctor did that was negligent? Can I identify something the nurse did that was negligent? Can I identify, you know, for example, some medical device or product or drug or something else that was used in the course of the medical treatment that would represent yet again another source of liability, yet another defendant in the case? And particularly if it's a product, I may be able to take advantage of some kind of strict liability as distinguished from the standard of reasonable care that applies to the hospital or medical personnel.
Okay.
So So again, you all keep referring, well, I read this test and read that test. Good. You know, hopefully as you read these things better than I can say to you, you get a feel, okay, this is the kind of thing that I should be prepared for, and here's how to handle these different scenarios. And I think I hope at least as you read these things, you say, oh, I see how that can be done. And some, oh, gee, I hadn't thought of that. I missed that one. Or here's a way in which I spent 4.5 pages on some issue, and here's a way I could have cleanly cut that Gordian knot, and bingo, I could have saved myself a lot of time. My question is, as you read these things, hopefully a lot of it is, oh, I see what you're after. Not necessarily that I can go do that, but at least I understand what the game plan is here. But I also want to hear about places where you're puzzled by something. Gee, I didn't expect this, and I still don't see why you did this rather than that. So any lingering just puzzlements about, well, why didn't you do this? I spent a lot of time on this, or why did you do this? I thought this was irrelevant, or etc. The problems that we had in the midterm in terms of, oh, go here, talk about this, don't go there, don't talk about that, I don't think you're going to see as much of that on the final. The things that you need to talk about will be much more kind of obvious. It's how to talk about it, obviously, that's tricky. Yes? Yes. Right. Yeah. Well, the parents could say the injury to my child caused an injury to me. In the same way that Marianne Rodriguez, Richard's still there, but he's different. Now, you know, that obviously a much more dramatic thing. Marianne's damages, her loss of consortium claim is huge. But the point is, I used to have this happy-go-lucky 12-year-old. Now she's very self-conscious about her thumb. You know, I take her, you know, I go to take her to the park to swim or whatever, and all the kids are looking at her thumb, and I see her turn away, you know. Again, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer, you earn your keep emphasizing things that, okay, yeah, okay, maybe it doesn't seem like such a big deal, but if I'm the defendant, I have to be prepared for the parents to show up. I think I mentioned before, I had this case against, or the firm I worked for had this case against the Air Force, where the girl puts her foot in what she thinks is a puddle of water on a January day, and it turns out it's a steam tunnel that has a little leak in it, and this is 180 degree water. She gets this very severe, second and third degree burns all up and down, essentially where her boot covered her foot, and this steaming water was held kind of in place there, burning her foot until they finally got it off of her. The parents had to take her to, again, that's a more severe injury than having the tip of your thumb cut off, but I mean, I'd rather err on the side of inclusiveness than say, oh, no, nobody would do that. You know, if you're either as the plaintiff, if you're the plaintiff's lawyer, remember you have a duty of informed consent. If you say to the parents, legally speaking, in this jurisdiction, you're entitled to claim for a change in the relationship with your child. If there is a change in the relationship with your child resulting from this injury, you're entitled to damages for that. Do you choose to bring that claim? That's the client's right to decide that. And they may say, huh? My kid, my relationship to my kid is different because they don't have the tip of their thumb anymore? You got to be kidding. Fine, okay. But I don't want to make that decision for them. Similarly, if I'm the defendant, I don't want to act like, oh, no thinking person, no lawyer with any sense of professional decency would bring a claim like that. You know, the defendant needs advance notice that get ready to see that claim show up in the complaint. And maybe you bargain that down. It's not worth very much money, but that's not... Yeah. Right. You don't need to go back and say negligence is a failure to use reasonable care. Reasonable care is judged by a variety of different standards. Industry, you know, the whole litany that you did to try to figure out. Once you've gotten to the point of saying the standard that is owed to an invitee is whether or not the defendant used reasonable care. Now, I would identify what it is that you think the plaintiff thinks is negligent, the act. For example, failing to inspect this railing, or after being notified that the railing, you know, wobbled a little bit, that they didn't secure it in a better fashion. So you identify what the negligent act is, but how this would be evaluated, industry custom, post-accident repairs, rule book, etc., all that stuff, no, I don't need to hear about that. There's a split opinion, and I think there's a note to that effect following Phillips versus Kimlin Machinery, because in fact they do use a post-accident repair argument in Phillips versus Kimlin Machinery, and I think I mentioned there's a split of opinion on that point. Again, it's just kind of a tangential thing there, that because jurisdictions view this as something other than a negligence. They say the post-accident repairs rule applies to negligence cases, but since this isn't really a negligence case, that rule doesn't apply in other jurisdictions. Yeah, but the policy's the same. Anyway, that's where you get the split of opinion. But I wouldn't worry about it. Again, there's a lot of stuff I throw at you in the notes and elsewhere. Interesting little stuff, but keep your eye on the priorities here and work from the high priorities as time permits to the low priorities, and that's what you want to do. I'm not averse to quitting early. You have miles to go before you sleep, as do I. I got to start thinking about what I'm going to put on this exam. So. Which, by the way, as much as I would like to help you from here until tomorrow at 9 a.m., I really can't. Because when you ask me, once I've formulated the question and you ask me something, I either tell you exactly what you need to know to solve the problem on this exam, or I say, don't worry about that, or I try to think, well, that wouldn't be fair, so then I try to tell you a bunch of stuff that I know you don't need to know, and it's a no-win situation for me. So, bug Susan, bug Gina, bug whoever else there is out there to get you to answer the question. If there's something really earth-shattering, they can refer it to me, but otherwise, I'll see you tomorrow morning at 9. Yeah, well, even straightforward questions are difficult.